This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
I've needed vision correction aids since I was in third grade. Translated, I've worn glasses, hard contacts, soft lenses, had LASIK surgery, and now lens replacement in both eyes. I appreciate how precious good vision is. I may take a wait-and-see approach with numerous health issues, but not with eyes. My guest is in complete agreement. Dr. Doug Essen is a board-certified veterinary ophthalmologist and practices in Orange County, California. We're going to chat about some of the most common eye ailments your pet may encounter, the signs, and what you can do. So I see you're really excited about this. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Does your dog itch, scratch, stink, or shed like crazy? Come to Dynavite for help. Order a 90-day supply of Dynavite. Pick up two bottles of Lico Chops, get the third bottle free. New improved Lico Chops with omega-6, omega-3, vitamin E, and now 6 extra direct-fed microbials. Even better for the digestive tract and immune system. And dogs love it. Try Lico Chops. Buy two, get one free. This is Henry Lukasevic for Dynavite.
DINOVITE.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Dr. Essen, thank you so much. And I am serious when I say I don't take chances with eyes. Things seem to go so wrong so fast. So thankfully, having a board-certified ophthalmologist like you in the area just gives me such great relief.
Well, good. Yeah, I think that's true. I think eye pathology is something that can move really quickly. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me as part of your podcast. And very happy, as always, to be a part of the Orange County veteran team. I think I'm certainly among the best in the world.
Well, I'm prejudiced. I think we are in a perfect area. For those people, however, who maybe don't have an ophthalmologist right around them, oftentimes I find people come in and they seem to be very surprised when I tell them their dog or cat is having eye issues. You know, you look at the little face, and oftentimes with pets having the dark irises, it's kind of like everything's dark in there. I can't really see anything. So if someone were to get a nice bright flashlight, get in some good lighting, and take a look at their pet's eyes, what is a normal set of eye structures that they'd be seeing?
Sure, that's probably a great place to start. So a bright flashlight and kind of a darkened room is a great way to do that, and that's how we do things routinely in the clinic and how I teach vet students and interns and vets to do it in their clinics. If you were to look at your animal's eye, and hopefully it would be cooperative, sometimes they're either not or they're exotic or zoo animals and we have to sedate or anesthetize them to do it. Externally, the tissues of the orbit are aligned by the eyelids. The eyelids have all kinds of interesting structures, including glands and hairs associated with them. Dogs and cats, unlike people, have an extra mobile third eyelid, which slides horizontally. The front part of the eye, the windshield, we'll often describe it out, or the clear layer is the cornea, and that's what your animal sees out of and what you see into. That should be bright and clear, and you should be able to see everything inside nicely. Everything inside then would be a fluid-filled anterior chamber, just like you or I, kind of like a little fish tank. A colored muscular ring or an iris, just like you or I, surrounding the hole in the middle, which is the pupil. A lens, which is suspended behind the iris and allows visual refraction and focal acuity. a posterior part, which is filled with a jelly-like material called the vitreous, again, just like you and I, and now we're probably crossing into territory that would be kind of hard to see without specialized equipment. And behind that, the many complex nerve layers of the retina and tissue, which eventually amalgamate to form the optic nerve and connect to the brain to make vision complete. And again, that's crossing into territory that you probably wouldn't see with a flashlight. You probably need some fancy eye toys to do that. But those mostly are the structures of the eyes that we deal with.
That was wonderful. And I love the way that you say, okay, that's the windshield and that's the fishbowl. Like, yeah, I think I'm going to steal some of those terminologies and use it in my own practice. I know people, and there's been some recent articles, are pets colorblind? And that really comes from the retina area. So if you could tell us, yes or no, are they colorblind?
That's a complex question to start picking apart. They do see colors. They see different spectrums of colors. So they probably see things a little more like people with color vision variations than a normal person.
So they can see color, maybe not the same that we do. I understand that even cats love their eyes, that cats can see in an ultraviolet range?
Cats and dogs will see in significantly reduced vision surroundings or low light surroundings is probably a better term, because of adaptions that they have. Some other animals have them as well. Even horses and cows have them. But layers of tissue inside the eye, which we call the tapetum, they're specialized crystalline-containing cells that lie underneath the retina, and they essentially bounce low light backwards and forwards so that your retinal cells get a couple of extra attempts at seeing even under very low light conditions. That adaption obviously helps prey animals avoid predators and helps predators find their prey animals. It's the reason that you'll often see a kind of a weird colored glow, or what a lot of people will describe as an eye shine reflex in the back of an animal's eye, the way you might imagine hyenas around a fire in Africa having glowing eyes. That's the shining crystalline material of the tapetum, which is a specialized low-light adaption that a lot of these animals have, but humans don't have a tapetum in the back of their eye.
And what makes it so hard to take flash pictures of them is like, okay, those little glowy eyes that they have. One of the things that I am just so impressed with is that you have really worked on a myriad of different animals. Does any of these various species really stick out in your mind as, that was, you know, one of the most challenging, fascinating cases that I've ever seen?
Wow. We've certainly done some interesting things with various critters around the world. Some rhinos in Africa a little while ago, some elephants in Thailand a little while ago. Probably the most challenging thing that we've dealt with, or that I've dealt with, have been the deep diving mammals here, some of the dolphins and cetaceans that we've dealt with for various groups. The challenges associated with even getting those guys to a point of eye examination, and in several cases we've gone on and performed some fairly significant surgeries associated with anesthesia, are interesting. We're kind of inventing our playground and building, in some cases, everything, including equipment, from the ground up. So I think probably the anesthesia and surgery associated with things like adult dolphins is probably about as challenging and white knuckle as it's been for me. But thankfully, everything's gone very well, and everybody is happy and visual to this point.
What did you have to do for the dolphin?
We've had several within the last 24 months. Most recently, we dealt with a kid who had a tumor, or what turned out to be a tumor, on the limbus of the eye, which is where the clear corneal windshield meets the white scleral shell of the eye. We knew there was a mass there. It was pigmented and it was growing. And that's the kind of thing we see not uncommonly in dogs and cats. And we're very happy to get in and remove those. A little bit more challenging in an animal that can open its eye and hold its breath and stare at you for 30 minutes, even with an ET tube in place. But our suspicion was that was probably something bad. And if we didn't do something about it, bad things would unfold. So in that case, we performed an excisional biopsy. We took out all of the tissue before submitting it for pathology. We filled in the defect that created with a graft of tissue and managed that medically afterwards. Healed up very nicely, and sure enough, our pathology indicated a melanoma with complete excision. I think if we hadn't taken that out, we'd have ended up with a sad situation, but everything's good. Everyone's happy.
Was this a dolphin that was in exhibit?
It was a working dolphin.
Okay. Working dolphin. Well, okay. It has a job. It could pay its medical bills. I like that. I really would like to right now kind of look into some of the common ailments that walk through my door and definitely walk through your door all the time. And kind of maybe let's start with the outside again and the eyelids. I know certain breeds like Sharpeys will come into the practice and they have these rolled in bottom lids, and entropion is a fancy term. And sometimes people aren't even aware of this. They're puppies or they just have all this tearing that's going on in their face. Explain what an entropion is and what can be done for it.
Sure. Yeah, good question. So we see a lot of eyelid-associated pathology, and one of the more common presentations is an eyelid that's rolled in or entropic. That can be in an adult animal for other reasons, usually associated with pain or discomfort, and we call those spastic entropions. Or more commonly in a young animal, it can be conformational, meaning that's the way the animal was made, and that usually needs to be corrected. If your eyelid rolls in, you can imagine with haired skin rubbing or braiding on the sensitive clear windshield of the eye, that's going to create problems, and it does, at best irritation, at worst ulceration or even perforation. And you can, as a young animal, lose both eyes fairly rapidly to entropion and its complications. So the tissue needs to be rolled away from the cornea so that it is, again, comfortable and pathology-free. When they're super young, what we tend to do is roll that tissue away temporarily, either with sutures or with surgical staples. We just kind of hold them back for a little while they grow and kind of fit their skull to their skin, if you like. When they're more mature, we tend to do something more permanent, and there are many, many permutations of eyelid surgeries described. It's the kind of thing that ophthalmology residents learn and practice year after year. But in simple terms, some tissue and some muscle gets taken away, and the eyelid is kind of rolled away from the corneal surface. It's sort of a plastic surgery, if you like, usually a very successful thing to do. And one of the reasons that we end up with dogs all over Orange County in the entertaining plastic cone of shame. They're usually in their cone for a couple of weeks after surgery while they heal up.
I have to laugh because you're calling it plastic surgery, and so many times people say, well, at least, you know, dogs and cats don't get plastic surgery, but here's a reason why it's for a medical need, and it's not just a cosmetic need.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, plastics or oculoplastics for us are moving tissues and muscles and things around the eye, the periorbital regions, always with a medical basis. And in human ophthalmology, there are people who deal with plastics. There are people who deal with strabismus or muscle surgery around the eyes. There are people who deal only with corneas or perform only glaucoma surgery or retinal specialists or whatever it might be. In veterinary ophthalmology, we're a little bit of everything, and oculoplastics is certainly in our toolbox.
Speaking of things that people can see very easily and need to have corrected, they come in and they think, oh my goodness, this pet has a tumor on the middle of its eye near its nose, and it's this kind of pink sticky out thing, and it'll be there and all of a sudden it's gone and then it's back again. So a cherry eye, if you could explain, what is a cherry eye and why does it need to be corrected, or does it need to be corrected?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. So a cherry eye, that's a breeder term and one that we hear a lot of. A cherry eye defines a prolapse of the gland of the third eyelid. So let me back that up a little bit. So we talked earlier about the structures of the eye and the fact that dogs and cats, unlike people, have an extra moving membrane or third eyelid that sweeps horizontally across the eye to protect it. It's supported by a T-shaped cartilage. And within that third eyelid is a gland which produces a very significant portion of the tears that help keep the surface of the eye bathed and protected and healthy. And in a significant number of animals, particularly what we call the brachycephalic dogs, so the sort of squash-faced animals like bulldogs, French bulldogs, Bostons, Frenchies, the cartilage associated with that gland can be weak, and that gland can just pop out of place. You know, this big, shiny, pink, swollen-looking thing associated with the third eyelid. And that's a prolapse of the gland, or what would be defined as a cherry eye. Important to remember that there are other things that can look like a cherry eye. So not every swelling associated with an animal's third eyelid is a cherry eye. There are abnormalities associated with all of the other tissues which can occur, including the cartilage. And very significantly, it's a site that we sometimes see neoplastic or cancerous cells developing. So that's one of the rule outs. If it's a cherry eye only, Yes, it needs to be repaired if the tissue is left dangling out there. As you can imagine, it gets swollen, it gets infected, damage to the gland occurs, and usually damage to the cornea occurs. There are, again, multiple techniques described with replacing that tissue. And again, in simple terms, usually we employ something that will involve putting it back into the little pocket that we create for it underneath there. That technique's actually called a Morgan pocket technique, and leaving the gland in place. Worth pointing out that it is important to leave that gland in place. We do see sometimes sad situations where folks with the best intentions remove those glands, and in a significant number of those cases, the loss of tear production that's associated with that procedure will cause major problems, potentially for the rest of that animal's life, because you removed a very significant portion of the tear production ability from the eye. So teary eyes occur in brachycephalic dogs. They're associated with important glandular tissue, and that tissue needs to be carefully replaced and preserved.
Do they ever go away by themselves permanently, or is it one of these waxing and waning situations?
Yeah, I don't think they go away by themselves. I do think it's reasonable to say they can wax and wane, particularly at first, you know, because the condition is associated with a laxity of connective tissue. And the young animals that are initially developing third-eyed gland prolapse or cherry eye, sometimes they're worse for a while, better for a while, worse for a while. Usually that curve is just steadily, though, trending in the direction of worse until they reach a point of complete prolapse. And once that happens, usually it just dangles out there. I'm not aware of a situation in which a cherry eye would just magically repair itself.
So if you see it, have something done. And I believe one of the long-term sequelae of removing that third eyelid, which is just really quick, versus putting it back into that little pocket that you mentioned, is getting a dry eye. And I know there's so many different things where you have an animal that has this really goopy, thick material, mucus on their eyes, and trying to clear that off. There's many things that can be done, but I think probably the key word is be careful of eyes. They do have so many components to their tears, a mucus portion, a liquid portion, that if there is a dry eye situation, imagine yourself being out in the middle of a windstorm and your eyes are just dry and they hurt. And correct me if I'm wrong, it can lead to a blindness.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, dry eye and its various sequelae are one of the commoner presentations that we see in dry eye. We'll often kind of ride shotgun with a lot of other eye pathology. As you correctly pointed out, the blanket term dry eye, or the correct term keratoconjunctivitis cica, can take many forms. That can be associated with not enough aqueous tear production. It can be associated with defects or abnormalities of the fat or the mucus components of the tear film, or in some cases can be associated with neurologic pathology, and neurologic pathology itself can be associated with all sorts of other things, including endocrine imbalances. So yeah, there's an enormous sea of potential variations and forms of dry eye, but it is important to keep the surface of the eyeball, particularly the cornea, bathed and protected. If not, pathology will always ensue, and absolutely unchecked, that can result in sequelae, including not only blindness, but ultimately even loss of the eye if the cornea ulcerates and then perforates.
So make sure, especially with eyes, that you follow your veterinarian's directions. You need to save those little eyes. There's only two. They are so precious. I'm chatting right now with Dr. Doug Essen. He's a board-certified veterinary ophthalmologist. We're going to be right back after this short break. And let's talk about the other extreme, having really wet eyes. What can cause that? So we'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your cat tree tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Oh!
Talk Pets.
Let's Talk Pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Essen, this is really fascinating, I think, for people because they're not realizing all the things that can happen to their pet's eyes. So right before the break, we were talking about dry eye, but now we have the other extreme. You see like the little white poodlet with the brown streaking around its nose. You see dogs that have really wet faces. The brachycephalic, and the way I always remember brachycephalic in veterinary school was they cephalic, I could do head, and brakes, they didn't put on the brakes, so they ran into the parked car and they have the squished in little face. So quickly, if you could say a little bit about excessive tearing and tear staining.
Yeah, wow, another big arena.
I give you only the easy questions.
Right. Obviously, as you pointed out, you do want the surface of the eye to be protected and bathed. That's how things are designed by biology. But yes, it's possible for there to be excessive tearing, lacrimation, and even tear staining, so wetness out onto the face, and then the tear staining that occurs because of some of the components that tears contain. Very often what people are noticing are the residues of the iron porphyrins, the metallic components, and that leaves kind of a red or a brownish stain to it. In some cases, that's associated with conformation or how these guys are put together. In some cases, it's associated with abnormalities of the haired margin around the eye, particularly in what we call the medial canthus or the nose side of the eyes. A tuft of hair in that position will sometimes suck or even wick the tear film out onto the surface of the face. In many cases, we see animals that have abnormal hairs around their eyelid margins in various forms. They can take the form of dystichia, which are little hairs along the eyelid margin that cause irritation and excess tearing. They can take the form of ectopic cilia, which are little hairs that actually emerge inside the eyelid margin and abrade and ulcerate the surface of the cornea and again create irritation and excessive tearing. We sometimes see animals that have abnormalities of the normal drainage pathways of the surface fluid layer of the eye, the nasolacrimal structures. And then sometimes pathology infections can create abnormal discharges and excessive tearing. The one that springs to mind, of course, is cats, which are very commonly affected by an upper respiratory viral family of diseases. And a lot of cats that have herpes will start manifesting as excessive tearing and discharge associated with that. So again, a lot of rabbit holes we could go down, but I think excessive tearing, just like excessive dryness, is a good reason to have a veterinarian check things out and see whether there's anything that should be done.
Dr. Essen, being a board-certified veterinary ophthalmologist, what are your views? I look at some of these breeds that are coming in, and I know they have their show haircut. So you'll have an old English sheepdog with this long fur in its face, or a Wheaton Terrier that also has these long bangs. Like, can you even see me, dog, through all this hair in your face? Is it appropriate to leave that fur there? Is it protective to those particular breeds? Or should you get their bangs out of their face?
Well, that's probably a political question. I don't know that I'm going to head off into what a breed standard should or shouldn't be, because that's probably out of my pay grade. But I like the idea of removing hair from around an animal's face. I feel like they're more comfortable and they're less likely to have problems than if they have a bunch of hair in their eyes. Just, I imagine, like either you or I would be, whether that's clipping it or tying it up. But again, I guess that comes down to the owners and breeders working with those animals. Certainly if anything is creating any kind of pathology, any ulcers or infections, et cetera, then obviously that needs to be dealt with straight away and corrected.
Speaking of ulcers, can you address that? Because I know there's been times I've gotten a scratch on my cornea and it is so exquisitely painful that you'll have a pet coming in and they're blinking with their eye and people have been watching us for the last week. Oh, maybe just got a little something in its eye and I've been putting this ointment that I use for myself, been putting it in their pet's eye. What are the hazards of doing that?
Yeah, wow, that's another enormous topic. We've actually just done...
Again, I only give you the easy ones. You have a half an hour.
We just did a little series of articles for The Pulse, actually, which is the veterinary magazine out here in California. And we did a chapter or section for lids and a section for the retina and a section for the lens, a little bit of everything. And the section for cornea was most challenging because that covers corneal ulcers, and it's just such a massive amount of territory. To put that in just a few pages or just a few comments is really hard. But yeah, I think corneal ulcers, some sort of abrasion or pathology associated with the surface of the clear windshield, probably the commonest reason that we see things, and it certainly has to be one of the commonest reasons that veterinarians in general practice see things. They can start for a myriad of reasons, either because there are underlying problems, things like the hairs and dry eye that we've talked about, obviously any number of traumas or scratches, just as would happen in people, and then a lot of hereditary diseases. We see a lot of ulcers that occur spontaneously, and that's always surprising to people. We talk often, for example, about boxer ulcers. Boxers are a breed that are known to develop ulcers spontaneously in their cornea, but many other breeds will do the same thing. And a lot of immune-mediated diseases will create spontaneous corneal ulcers as well, which can be a challenge to manage. So, yeah, they can come up quickly. They are, as you said, very, very painful. They need to be managed fairly intensively, and they can move quickly. A corneal ulcer can turn from something minor into something major in just a very short period of time, within a day or two. That means that staying on top of them, managing them, and monitoring them aggressively and referring them when necessary, I think, is an important part of the algorithm. In some cases, those ulcers reach a point where they can't be managed medically anymore, and then just as they do in people, we manage them surgically with a whole family of surgical grafting techniques and procedures that can be used to repair a badly damaged cornea, up to and including a cornea that's completely perforated or ruptured apart. That's still something that's fixable, but now we've moved into the territory of operating microscopy and fairly advanced eye surgery.
One of the things, just very simplistically, I find with many of my own clients, all right, it has an abrasion, just kind of a scrape on the cornea. It's not very deep. And okay, here's the medication, and I'll send home an Elizabethan collar so they can't rub at it. They come back a week later so I can check it again, and it's gotten worse. So is your pet wearing the collar? Oh, no, no, it's not rubbing at it. Just go ahead and humor me. Leave this thing on 24/7, and let's see it back in a week's time. They come back in a week's time. The eye is completely healed. I said, so, did you wear the collar all the time? Yes. So I'd love to have you really promote the fact that please follow your veterinarian's advice.
Absolutely. I mean, encouraging people to keep the cone of shame on is one of our ongoing challenges. We do it all the time, and I understand folks don't like them. They're not comfortable for the animals. They're a pain, especially if you have a dog that weighs 100 pounds or more. That's kind of a tank in your house. But animals, unfortunately, will on the whole not leave pathology alone. It's in their nature to go and rub at things and scratch at things and paw at things. Most of the time in doing so, they will make it worse. Most of the time, if they can leave things alone and be medicated appropriately, they will heal up nicely. I'll often encourage people by saying, hey, if we can get this healed medically, you're good with your drops and you're diligent with your cone, I think this will heal itself up. If it doesn't, we're probably all going to end up in the OR with an anesthetic event and a fairly expensive surgical bill. And that's often a good way to have people say, yeah, you know what, I'll suck it up and I'll deal with the cone. I think it's probably also worth saying that a cone is not a cone is not a cone. And by that, I mean that most of the rigid protective e-collars are effective. I kind of like the clear ones. That's what we use in our clinic here at VOC because they can at least see out of them. I think it's a bit less challenging for them, and they have a Velcro fastener. But what I'm usually not a fan of are the alternate cones, so the inflatable donuts and the Velcro floppy cones, those kinds of things. Most animals, because animals are smart, will find a way to get up to a piece of furniture or the corner of the bed or whatever it is and still abrade, damage, and scratch the surface of the eye when they're in anything other than a rigid protective cone. So I kind of like the rigid ones, and where possible, I like them to be clear.
I totally agree with you, especially for eyes. One of the other things that comes to the door that I find very challenging for me to diagnose early on is glaucoma. And I know this is a very complicated, huge area, but simplistically, what may a pet owner see that makes, you know, the red flags go up, the bells chime that say, no, I need to take this pet in now, that would be associated with glaucoma?
Wow. Yeah, that's, I've said a couple times, that could be a long answer to a short question, but that really is the mother of all of them. Glaucoma is probably the most complex and potentially troubling thing that we deal with. It's one of the leading causes of blindness in both people and animals. So to back that up, what is glaucoma? Even that's not a simple answer, but for the purposes of this discussion, we can say that glaucoma is usually associated with too much pressure in the eye. the abnormally high pressure in the eye can be either a result of birth defects, so it can be both congenital and hereditary. Thankfully, that's fairly rare. It can be primary, meaning it's associated with hereditary defects, things that come from one or both parents and manifest as time goes by, usually starting at about midlife. Or it can be secondary because of any one of the other things that can go wrong in an eye. If you have bleeding in your eye, if you have retinal separation in your eye, if you have inflammation and infection, a lens luxation, uveitis, any one of a myriad of things, the end path in most cases is glaucoma. Eyes will try to develop glaucoma when things go wrong. So primary hereditary issues, secondary something else bad happened in the eye. In all cases, the goal is to try and lower pressure, and that can be done in various ways, usually surgically in veterinary medicine. Unfortunately, animals have a somewhat different outflow tract to people. People have this very beautiful radial canal of Schlemm, as do non-human primates. It's a nice structure, and it's a lot harder to get some of the really damning pressures and pathologies in people that we see really commonly in dogs. Dogs don't have a canal of Schlemm. They have a thing called a trabecular meshwork, and it's a drain that's easily plugged up. To come back to your question, how would you know? Very tough. Any one of a number of things, redness, vision loss, pain or discomfort, closing of the eye, prolapse of the third eyelid, or fluid accumulating in the windshield and manifesting as corneal edema, a blueness or a grayness. So anything that seems significantly abnormal is something that your primary veterinarian should check out. I think all primary veterinarians should have a reasonable radar for, hey, this could at least be glaucoma. I think most veterinarians in our part of the world have the ability to check the pressure in the eye with an instrument called a tonometer. There are a lot of different kinds out there. And really, I don't think it's as important what kind you use as long as you actually have access to some sort of tonometry. And then, yes, as you've already mentioned, one of the other big concerns is that glaucoma in animals can move extremely fast, and a day or two can be the difference between we're going to salvage an eyeball or not salvage an eyeball. So if glaucoma is present or the suspicion is there that glaucoma might be present, that's an indication for an immediate referral to an ophthalmologist. The final thing to bear in mind is that a lot of eyes that have these problems, should those occur in one eye, will then develop in the other eye. So if you have an animal that's had glaucoma in one eye or had an eye removed for whatever reason, those are great reasons to say, you know what, let's have an eye person check out the other eye and see what the potential is for the development of a similar set of pathology and, of course, what we can do to try and head that off.
Dr. Essen, you were mentioning that the windshield could start looking bluish in color because it's getting swollen. One of the things clients come in, and I love to have them stand up as I'm doing an examination and, or sit down, depending on the size of the pet, as I'm going through, you know, go through each body system and we're looking at the eyes. And thankfully, so many pets are living to be in their senior years. And so we're going through and going, okay, you see the grayness that's in the lens. This grayness is not cataracts. Like, oh, I thought that was cataracts. And I explain, it's the lens has gotten older, it's gotten thicker, it's gotten less flexible. The change doesn't lead to cataracts in dogs and cats, it does in people. So this condition, lenticular sclerosis versus cataracts, in about 2 minutes, if you could give us kind of a rundown of what is lenticular sclerosis, what's a cataract, what can be done?
You're spot on, though. Yes. So we are. I'm going to back up and address a couple of the points that you hit nails on heads with there. First off, we're seeing a significant number of very much older patients in the clinic. The anesthesiologist I work with will describe them as a super octogenarian when we're dealing with anesthetics, because it's really not uncommon now for us to be anesthetizing 16, 17, 18-year-old pets. There are a lot of age-associated changes that will actually affect the windshield, the cornea. A lot of the aging degenerations and mineralizations will occur and sometimes be misconstrued as owners as a cataract, and they're not. They're corneal pathology. You're right. A cataract is an opacity or a change inside the lens, which is a structure inside the eye, not on the outside of the eye. Cataracts can occur for all kinds of different reasons. The two most common that we see in clinical practice are either hereditary cataracts, again, meaning they came from one or both parents, or metabolic, and the commonest one there is diabetic animals will almost always develop cataracts, which need managing. And the differential is, as you rightly pointed out, in older animals, the lens will become thicker. As you get older in life as a dog, you're laying down more and more lens fiber layers in your lens. And the lens becomes denser, it becomes sclerotic or thickened. And from 10 or 15 feet away, yes, that's kind of a grayish lens. It's not a cataract, though. If you shine a direct light through it, and that's the kind of thing a veterinarian can do in the darkened room that we opened talking about, that beam of light is not interrupted by a sclerotic lens. And that's how you tell the difference between a cataract, where there will be an opacity and a shadow where you can't see through, compared to a sclerotic lens, where light will pass through and you can see the reflexes and the retinal structures and things at the back of the eye just fine. And looking at a bunch of cataracts and looking at a bunch of sclerotic lenses will help veterinarians get a feel for which one is which. I have a couple of textbooks out there, and in our clinical atlas, we have a nice panel of sclerotic lenses and a nice panel of cataractous lenses, and that's a great place to go and take a look at one and compare to the other. That's available on Amazon. There's my shameless plug on behalf of my publisher, Blackwell Wiley. But yes, sclerosis is an age-associated change, and cataracts are a pathologic change. Cataracts cause vision impairment. Sclerosis, not significantly. Probably it does have an effect on the animal's refractive acuity, their fine focus ability, but typically that's not something we tackle surgically in animals.
I always say they need cheater glasses. So there is something that can be done for cataracts, just like for people.
Absolutely, and it really is just like for people. In animals with mature cataracts, meaning animals that have lenses that are so opaque that they can't see out of one or both eyes, we'll often talk about removing that lens by cataract surgery. Not every cataract in an animal is an indication for surgery. Many animals have fairly small degrees of cataractous change to the lens. It doesn't significantly affect vision, and those animals we just manage medically. But if we're at the point where one or both eyes is blind, that's different, and it's very rewarding to be able to fix that. We usually investigate those animals a little more to find out that all the tissues at the back of the eye do work. We do some electrical and flashlight testing of predominantly the retinal structures, just to make sure that, hey, if we go through this complex exercise, we're going to end up with a visual patient. If they pass all of their pre-surgical testing, then the surgery is similar, although of course in animals there are anesthetized, and people in many cases, that same phaco emulsification surgery can be performed with a local block in someone who's awake. The lens material is broken up or phaco fragmented by a tiny little ultrasonic probe removed from the lens. And then in many cases, a new synthetic lens is replaced inside the capsule. I say in many, not in all, because in some cases there's pathology inside the eye that dictates placing a synthetic lens back in there isn't a great idea. That doesn't happen super commonly, but it does happen. That's a decision that's usually made by the surgeon at the time of surgery. That's an intraoperative decision. And even those animals who don't have a synthetic lens placed will typically go on and do very well. They still have functional vision. Occasionally people will somehow infer that not having a lens creates blindness or renders blindness, and it doesn't. Be very similar to taking your reading glasses off. You can still see. You just probably can't see the back of the Sunday Times from 10 feet away. So yes, in simple terms, cataract surgery in animals is very similar to cataract surgery in people. The major difference, at least in my experience, is in the amount of inflammation that animals will create in their eyes. A human eye, a non-primate eye, has been very nicely biologically regulated through some beautifully described processes that reduce the amount of inflammation after an injury or a surgical procedure. An animal's eye gets much angrier, in simple terms, creates an awful lot more inflammation on many levels, and that inflammation has to be managed very aggressively after surgery. Usually the first few weeks we're pretty busy with drops, and in my experience we're usually using at least some sort of anti-inflammatory medication for the full duration of the animal's life, for the rest of their lives. So complex undertaking, but a very rewarding thing. To have an animal come in blind and go home visual is a really nice thing.
Well, it sounds as though you have a very rewarding career, that you're really enjoying what you're doing, and you're giving sight to animals, making sure that they maintain their vision. It's your last words of wisdom to our listeners right now about eyes. What would that be?
Well, I think it's probably not a bad idea to have them looked at once a year. I think following the advice of your veterinarian is a great place to start. And if in any way you're not sure about how things are unfolding or your veterinarian's not sure, then think of the Vet Eye Guides as a great resource that you and or your veterinarian can reach out to and say, hey, we'd like a little guidance. We'd like someone to look over our shoulder at this case as we manage it along to make sure we have a happy outcome.
Great. And don't take chances with your pet's eyes. There's two, as you've heard from Dr. Essen, things can go wrong so quickly, and many things can look very similar. So when in doubt, make that appointment, see your veterinarian, and if appropriate, have a referral to a board-certified veterinary ophthalmologist. So Dr. Essen, thank you so much for being with us today. Yes, we could go on for those 2 hours, I can tell. So this is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. You've been listening to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Please tune in again next week. We'll give you some more information on how to make you that best possible pet owner. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.